Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement meeting will come to order February 10th, 6:15. The first item on the agenda tonight is the final review of the pension and retirement principles. And if my memory serves me, it is the final review. We've done most of them, but there was just one set left over. And I had assigned Mr. Stoffel and other concerned people to come back with some suggested language other than what we had in front of us at the last meeting. Commissioner or Senator Rosen, welcome to the commission.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And Senator Pappas has been also appointed to the commission since the last time that we met. The House members have been reappointed, and I assume Senator Betzel's been reappointed, and Senator Lynch and Senator Olson. So we're full complement. And it's been a long time since we have been. On the principles, Mr. Martin, do you want to tell us where we left off and where we're going to start?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure where we left off with the principles. Maybe Mr. Stoffel is
okay, I think it was under substantive principles of B3. Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair, my name is Jay Stoffel, Director of the Teachers Retirement Fund, and I do have a page that we could distribute. I don't see the changes that I mailed to you a while ago in the packet, but I do have some pages on one page. Is that going around?
Yes.
Okay.
The sheet that you gave me today.
Okay. Since the last meeting, I've worked with Brian Rice, Sherry Munyon, Niall Zickman, and met with a few of the people on the Pension Commission. And the language that was just distributed would be inserted in Roman numeral 2, section B, number 3. There would be two new items, small letter C and D. And this pertains to consolidation of smaller public pension plans. And basically, in a nutshell, letter C is basically no loss of benefits to any member of the consolidating or merging plan. And letter D is a vote of the active members, the employers, and the boards of directors or trustees of the affected plans in a situation where there is a merger or consolidation. So that language was worked over and agreed to by the parties that I mentioned. And this is what we're suggesting tonight as for your consideration.
And is there past practice on your suggested changes, additions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think there's a lot of past practice in this state. Police and fire consolidations, local police and fire funds merging into PERA have followed a process that's very well laid out and very well thought out, very thoughtful process of several layers of voting. So there's a lot of record in this state of the voting that goes on in a voluntary consolidation. The members of the plan initiate the movement. It goes to a vote of the city council, it goes to the para board, it goes to the state board of investment, there's actuarial work. It goes back again for final consideration of the members of the plan and to PERA. And so there's a lot of steps involved in those consolidations. And I think when I was working at para, I think I may have done 30 of those. In fact, helped that process along. So a lot of voting there. 2 years ago, when the Minneapolis Teachers was merged into TRA, they had a vote of their membership as well. The First Class City Teacher Funds may be unique in this respect, but we are organized under Minnesota nonprofit laws, and that does require a vote of the membership to liquidate or dissolve the corporation. So that vote was taken as well.
Representative Khan.
Madam Chairman, I'll move to pass that line.
Is there any more discussion? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I'm wondering is on the no loss of pension benefits, do these, the only thing I worry about is when they get merged in, I think maybe current pension benefits, because at some point the benefits have to change going forward so they kind of become the same, right? I don't know if that's a loss or not. That would be the only thing that I would, that comes to mind. You know, so for instance, the Minneapolis Teachers had a different kind of benefit set design than TRA. And as a forward going matter, I think they're kind of coming together.
Mr. Snoffel.
Madam Chair, to Representative Thiessen's point, I think inserting the word no loss of current pension benefits would maybe handle that situation. But in the case of the Minneapolis Teacher merger, there was a benefit improvement tied to that. For both parties, but no loss of current benefits would be.
Representative Thiessen.
I'll accept that.
Oh. Representative Khan will accept inserting the word current. Is that right? Any further discussion? All in favor of the Khan amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Then the document with the amendment is before us as a whole. Are there any other discussion items of the document that you want to discuss further tonight? We spent 5 months on this now.
Representative
Khan.
Don't the new members have to take a test on
that? That will be up to the new chair. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, the Representative Khan, you're just lucky that the new member actually read the print.
Representative Thiessen.
No, I just think, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think before we, not that that's before, but thank you for pushing this through. I think it was important work, and I know it took a lot of your time. So just to acknowledge all the effort you put into this.
You're welcome, and I imagine in another 10 years, another chair will do it. I think. Maybe not.
They always do wrong in the
year. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to address any point of the principals? Someone has signed up. Dr. Norman Entrick. Is there anyone else? Welcome to the committee, and please state your name so that I will remember to pronounce it correctly.
My name is Norman Ehrenreich. And I would like to speak to Section E, Pension Plan Investments. And I have to apologize. In the beginning, I heard you said final consideration, and I want to open a whole other can of worms at this moment. So I hope you can forgive me that I found out about this meeting so late. I would like to make the case for liability-driven investments for public pension plans. And I know that many of you probably think that is not the appropriate investment strategy, especially for public pension plans. But I would like to make the case that they are probably more cost-efficient than other investment strategies. The risk-reducing aspect of liability-driven investments are well accepted, yet there is one common objection, and this is that they rely heavily on fixed income investments, and because of their lower expected returns, it is most likely true that their long-term funding costs would be higher for public pension plans who would adopt liability-driven investment strategies. I contend, however, that this conclusion is too premature. To convert an eventual equity risk premium into lower funding costs, certain requirements need to be fulfilled. In reality, most of them are violated, and public pension plans tend to violate them to a higher degree than corporate pension plans, as I have shown in a recent study with the Plan Sponsor magazine. As a result, I predict that public pension plans will be much costlier than they need to be and costlier than their corporate peers. Unfortunately, I cannot lay out the full argument in full here at this moment, and I would welcome the opportunity if I can present this argument at a later point in more detail. But I would like to mention a few basic principles of this argument. First, to convert an equity risk premium into lower funding costs, pension plans need to be, on average, fully funded. The cost-saving aspects of LDI stem from its ability to keep a fully funded pension plan at funding levels near 100%. Other investment strategies produce huge swings in funding level. However, as we can see right now, when a significant drop in investor and funding status occurs, plan sponsors may not be able to close these funding gaps immediately. Their ability to do so is highly correlated with investment returns. This makes underfunding persistent. Accounting rules such as asset and liability smoothing similarly increase the probability of being underfunded for extended periods of time. In addition, a pension plan that is underfunded needs to earn substantially more than its discounting rate just to maintain its funding level. The investment's return needed to earn one's way out of the funding gap often exceeds reasonable return expectations. From my perspective, there's no viable alternative to additional contributions if a plan finds itself underfunded. Relying on investment returns to close funding gaps encourages excessive risk-taking and is, in my opinion, not prudent. While underfunded, pension plans have to keep paying out current benefit payments. It is these current benefit payments that cause the link between average investment returns and average funding costs to break down. It is based on an effect known to individual retirement planners as reverse dollar cost averaging. While individuals may be able to adjust their spending downwards, defined benefit pension plans usually are unable to do so. It can lead to a situation where an LDI portfolio with lower average returns can have lower funding costs than a higher earning equity portfolio. In my research, I argue that for the reasons mentioned above, this possibility is the standard case for most defined benefit pension plans. I call this for defined benefit pension plans the asset return funding cost paradox. I'd like to close by asking you to seriously consider liability-driven investment strategies to play a role for Minnesota public pension plans. In my opinion, requiring healthy pension plans to follow LDI strategies would reduce the contribution by future taxpayers and the risk of future failure. Thank you. I'm sorry, it's a whole another can of worms, and it probably wouldn't want to.
It certainly is, and it would have had, perhaps your words would have been different when we had discussed this section in August, if certainly the financial situation of our plans was different at that time, too. And could you submit something to us in writing? Because we can go back into the principles at any time if we would like to consider changing them. But if you could submit something to us in writing so that we could peruse it at our future time and talk with Mr. Bicker, who may have some questions. But also, could you tell us who you are other than just your name? Why should we listen to you? I mean, we don't know you. So a lot of the people in this room are regulars, and that so we get used to them. But somebody comes in with a new idea like this, and we need a little more assurance. So not that I'm doubting in any way what you're saying, but I don't quite understand what liability-driven means.
So first to my name. So I'm Norman Ehrenfeld, and I originally come from Germany. I moved here about 5 years ago. I finished my PhD in economics about 6 years ago at the University of Halle-Wittenberg in Germany. And I came here then to work for a major investment advisor firm in Minneapolis. So I'm a quantitative investment analyst in the fixed income department. So there may be a conflict of interest here. So if I tout LDI strategies. But in that capacity, I actually developed liability-driven investment strategies. And I stumbled upon this asset return funding cost paradox. And right now, I'm actively trying to publish this, get it accepted in the academic community, and get it out. So it's relatively new. I think it's unknown or not accepted in the investment community. But as I said, the asset return funding cost paradox, the principle that it can happen, I can prove, I can imagine there is some objection to my contention that this is a standard case. So in liability-driven investment, the definition is you match your liabilities with your assets. So, and the type of assets that then can do that are fixed income investments. So you need certain assets with a defined duration. So your liabilities have a certain duration, and you want to match that with your assets. So by mandating or asking for liability-driven investment, I do not necessarily ask that you invest 100% in fixed income. So liability-driven investment is more of a principle. So you may have many different investment strategies that follow, or investment types, investment classes, assets that can do that. So while I personally believe 100% fixed income is the best, I am open for other options too, like derivative overlays or so. So it's not overly limiting the investment universe, but I think it's a very good idea to have as a risk management tool and also as a cost savings tool to pursue liability-driven investment strategies for any defined pension plan.
Madam Chair?
Representative Nelson?
I guess the question is, you said you're discussing E, which is pension plan investment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not going to admit that I understand all of what you're talking about. It's a little bit over my head, but reading through here, I don't see there's anything in here that precludes us from doing that, or from the people that do the investments to be using those strategies. This is just a basic principle of policy that we want them to follow. I don't see anything written in here that says we can't use LDIs as part of the mix of investments they do, and so I don't know where your objection would be. I guess that's my question.
It's not an objection. I think certainly public pension plans could use it. I would go a step further and actually encourage, mandate the use of LDI for public pension plans, and that's a much much bigger step.
And would you have the money? A solution for us to find the money to go into that if we did decide to change on all for all the, for all the plans?
I don't really know how to answer this question. right now, I suppose many of the public pension plans are underfunded, but independent of the investment strategy. I think that following equity-based investment strategies, they are way too risky, so we don't know yet how the financial crisis is going to turn out, so So equities may still go down, and while you may, it's even worse for liability-driven investment strategies, they do not lock down a funding deficit. They tend to make it bigger because they do not earn a discounting rate bigger than theirs, but it's at least an insurance that we won't have another catastrophic year like the last one.
Have you written something about this?
I have written two white papers, and I'm actually I have submitted to academic journals, and I'm waiting for their decision. I have one positive review so far. I need the second referee to get a positive review too.
We would appreciate receiving them and going through them.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Bicker, do you have any comment? Mr. Bicker is investment counsel.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I'm Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the Investment Board. We're very aware of liability-driven investment solutions, and they've been talked about and bannered about in the investment community for quite some time. The reality is basically a liability-driven solution is your contributions are put into your plan equal to the current interest rate. So let's say we're going to use 10-year treasuries as our discount rate today. 10-year treasuries are yielding around 3%. We are currently assuming 8.5% in our plan. We would have to increase contribution rates from what a 8.5% would discount to what a 3% would have to discount. So really what you're doing is taking, for all practical purposes, all investment risk out of your equation. You are also, and again, today is not a wonderful day to be talking about the stock market, but you are reducing or eliminating your ability to add value in the sense of long-term expected returns. In other words, stocks are really not a viable alternative. International is not a viable alternative. Private equity is not a viable alternative because you do not know your return. So what you're doing is taking all risk out of the equation and adding it all to the upfront cost of your plan. So a liability-driven solution, in a perfect world, is a great thing. It's just very expensive. And if you're prepared to do that, we can put that in tomorrow. But it's going to cost a lot of money. Now, again, today and over the last 12 months, obviously the market has not been very good to us. But over the last 30 years, we've probably earned around 8.5%. On a liability-driven solution, you're probably assumed rate, if you average it out, probably be more 5%. And, your normal cost would have gone from wherever it is today, 10%, to probably 14%, 15%, 16%. So it's really a risk-reward kind of deal. Do we want to take no risk in the investment side of the equation on any of these pension plans and fund it all up front and basically buy very secure fixed income securities with durations equal to the projected liabilities? So, Madam Chair, that's trying to be probably slightly oversimplistic, but the professor and whoever can fill in whatever you like.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bicker. So going back to my question, is there anything in these Section E that he quotes here that prevents us from doing that at the current time?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I do not believe so. It would just change the funded requirements.
Okay, Representative Khan.
A simple question. Is there any pension plan anywhere in the world that is using this?
Madam Chair and Representative Khan, some corporate plans are because of the ERISA laws and their requirements, but obviously they're putting significant money. To my knowledge, no public entity is.
Doctor?
I agree that there are public corporate pension plans, and numbers range between 5 to 50%, so it depends how you define LDI. I do not know of any public pension plan who uses that, but I still think it would, in the long term, be the more cost-efficient solution. And in terms of discounting rate, so he used the 10-year treasury. Of course, you can use corporates, and corporate spreads are, you know, quite high. So if you look at these numbers, so it doesn't look that bad anymore. So.
Mr. Bicker, could you give us a rough estimate of, say, an average public employee, what would the amount of money that they would have to put in for their contribution, how much more would that be?
Madam Chair and members, that is something you really need to talk to the retirement directors about. That's not my area, or Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Well, you certainly, Doctor, you've certainly given us something to think about, and we would wish to, we will read whatever you wish to send to us, and we appreciate that you, even at this late time, came and to try to teach us something new. Thank you.
Thank you for
having me here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Zickman?
Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman representing the Fire Department Association and Minnesota Fire Chiefs.
Yeah.
The previous discussion, there's probably a couple hundred volunteer fire reliefs and CDs that are LDIs, and they just didn't know it. So, specifically to... specifically to the principals, I want to thank the commission, you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Stoffel for working on that language. You know that some of the members of the commission know it's been a long journey with the volunteer reliefs and trying to craft a solution that wasn't mandatory. And there is a bill that's been worked on in the interim with PRA staff. Madam Chair, you know you're the House author, and Senator Betzel is the Senate author. That was introduced on the Senate side Monday. It will be in on the House side Thursday, I believe. But it, in fact, embraces these principles, so it's good that they now align with the bill that's going to be submitted and hopefully in front of the commission, and letting those cities join on a voluntary basis. That's clear language to cause that to happen, allow them to elect their benefit level so there's no reduction in the benefit level. So, and I'd like to thank the commission, you, Madam Chair, for working on this, and Mr. Stoffel for coming up together. And full support of it. I want to get that on the record.
All right, is there anyone else that wishes to make a comment about the pension principles, the completed final pension principles? If not?
Madam Chair.
Senator?
I'll move that the amended Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement Principles pension policy be adopted.
Any further discussion? Favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. The principles that will be in place until they're amended, which could be any time. The minutes of the December 18th meeting are before us.
Madam Chair, I'll move those.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of the amendment as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is or the minutes are adopted as printed. The third item on the agenda today is just for an overview for the commission's knowledge, so that we know the governor's in the governor's budget, he's making a recommendation for a change in the corrections plan. And I invited the commissioner, the Office of Budget Management, somebody to come before us and talk to us about the governor's proposal. Yes, there's the budget sheets are here. be passed out. This is for information purposes. There is no bill before us. There's no bill that I have seen yet. And so until that time, I don't think that we need public testimony until the bill is before us. But welcome, Commissioner. Welcome, Assistant Commissioner. Larson.
That's correct. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Management Department.
And Commissioner Fagan. And I'm Joan Fagan, Commissioner. Thank you so much for coming before us. Please, Commissioner Larson, are you going to present, or is Commissioner Fagan?
Madam Chair, I'm going to start out, and Mr. Larson has a lot of the detail that I don't have, so he's going to just add some of the figures that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm here to present Governor's recommendations contained in our budget that are related, of course, to the early corrections, early retirement. And I know that we have, the Madam Chair knows our budget, and so does Representative Smith and Senator Rosen. But just to kind of give you a little background of why we got to where we are today, in the last, a 5% reduction for corrections would total $46 million. We needed $22 million just to keep the staff that we have now. If we didn't get, and it's all for, actually it's really for the what we have now, no increases, but just to pay the staff that we have with insurance and so forth, we need an additional $22 million in our budget. Saying that, in addition to their talking about, 5% cut. So one of the things that we presented to finance was the fact that we have increased with our prison population 67% in the last 10 years at a time, the same time in the last 6 years, we've reduced our budget by $85 million. We just can't keep sustaining this. And I think that one of the previous cuts back in the 2004-05 budget was to double bunk at two of our high security prisons, which St. Cloud and Stillwater. $32 million was taken out of our budget, and we were supposed to double bunk up to 880 beds. The first year that happened, it was a disaster. We saw very soon that we couldn't keep doing this. It was very difficult to handle inmates. We had increased assault between inmates. We had assaults on staff. So we made the decision to not double bunk. It was putting our officers and our other staff at risk. And so as part of that, we have a we only realized $13.4 million because we double bunked 364 beds instead of the 880. So we have a deficit of about $19 million in the biennium because of that. It's case after case of this. The other thing that happened was our budget was cut $1.8 million so that we could do a program, an early release program. We did not have the low-risk offenders to do that. So we now, and we realized only $215,000 for that, savings that we were supposed to have. So we're getting to the point where right now, just in this year's budget, we have a $10 million deficit. Part of it is insurance. The early retirement insurance back in 2001 was, in 2002, our contribution was $1.8 million. In 2008, it's $4.8 million. This reduction, I have to say, has absolutely nothing to do with how valuable the staff are, what they do. I think every single one of them you know, deserves to have whatever, you know, whatever what they came into the plan believing that that was what they were going to get. We cannot keep sustaining this all the out years. And I'll now, after I get into that, what the actual recommendation is that it removes the 800 non-security staff from the corrections employee retirement plan. So there's 800 that are in categories like nurses, teachers, caseworkers, all who are still in the same danger situation in the prison. They're not the first responders is what the difference is. Security staff also were looking at having 10 continuous years of service. And Mr. Larson will get into some of the problems that have come without having that in the plan. Right now, as at the early retirement as an employer, we contribute 11.1% of the gross wages into this CERP plan, and the general fund plan, we contribute about 4.75. So it's a huge amount of money that goes into it. And I think I'm just going to turn it over here to Paul, and Paul can just talk about some of the issues that have come up with this that I think are important. Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, the part of the Governor's recommendation was to address an issue with regard to the tenure or the vesting period for the correctional pension plan. And I think it would be helpful if I take you back a little bit to the history of some of the issues that transpired as a result of this. This was back to 1971 when the Public Employee Labor Relations Act was first enacted. The very first labor agreement in the state provided for the correctional retirement plan. It also had some unique features to it. It provided for an increased employer contribution. It was also mandatory that you had to retire at age 55. And when the legislature found out that the state had negotiated a retirement plan, the legislature amended PELRA and prohibited the state and other public sector organizations from ever negotiating pension benefits. That's your business. As a result of that, they removed it from the labor agreement and codified it into the Chapter 390 in the Minnesota State Retirement System. And at that point, the early retirement and the correctional plan was mandatory. You had to retire at age 55. And you also had to have 10 years of service in that position, a correctional covered position, in order to be able to retire at age 55. At the time in 1972, when they codified this into the law, prior to that, it was only correctional officers. But then at that time, they also expanded it to special teachers in our correctional facilities. They also expanded it to make certain maintenance job classifications, and then they also included it for the security counselors at the security hospital in St. Peter. We then, for a period of time, from 1973 until 1979, administered the correctional retirement plan. There was no insurance, no employer-paid insurance during that time. It was only in 1979 that the mandatory retirement was removed from the law. And this was removed from the law, which was really based on some what I would call sweeping legislation that was passing throughout the United States on all age-based benefits. And so the mandatory retirement was removed in 1979. However, because of the concerns and the exigencies of the job, the legislature enacted legislation that would require employees at age 55, if they wanted to work beyond age 55, that they had to submit themselves for a physical that was administered by the employer. That brings us then to 1983. And in 1983, the state and labor contract negotiations agreed to pay for the insurance for the employees who retired at age 55 in the correctional retirement plan. And what that meant was that we would pay the employer contribution as if they were an active employee. We pay for the dental insurance and the medical insurance. And at that point, we pay for the employer contribution for single coverage and 100% of the contribution for single coverage and 85% for family coverage. But in order to keep this going, the union and the employer agreed that in order to be eligible for this employer-paid insurance, you had to retire at age 55. And this has later been developed as the use-it or lose-it benefit. In other words, the union and the employer agreed that while we had gotten rid of the mandatory retirement, this incentive to leave at age 55, if you gave it up at age 55, then you would forego the benefit. During the 1980s, there were a few other job classes that were added to the correctional retirement plan. Correctional cooks were added to the plan. Also, there were a couple of other small classes that were added in as far as size to the correctional retirement plan. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the demographics of this unit at that time in the correctional retirement plan. Generally speaking, the correctional guards were long-term officers. They were hired at an early age, on average, and looking at the demographics of this unit, most of the people that were retiring at that time had about 25 years of service in the correctional retirement plan when they reached age 55. During the 90s, there were attempts to add more job classes to the correctional retirement plan. This was met by resistance by Commissioner Pung, who was a commissioner of corrections at that time, and the discussions that I recall from Commissioner Pung was, where will it stop? He was concerned about the proliferation. Mr. Pung retired, and ultimately the legislature, through legislation, agreed to add, in about 1995, they added 500 employees to the correctional retirement plan, and subsequent to that, we had added about another 150 more employees to the correctional retirement plan. And also, during this period of time, the legislature reduced the vesting period from 10 years in order to be eligible for the pension in the correctional retirement plan from 5 years, and now down to 3 years in the correctional retirement plan. It was during that time in the late 90s, Madam Chair, that I began to look at the demographics of this unit. And with those newly added employees, I noticed a significant change in the age population of this group. They were in the late 40s. Some of them were in their early 50s. And so as a result of that, what I started to observe in this is that employees with the 3-year vesting were able to retire at age 55 with the 10 years of insurance. And that became a growing concern to me, because up until then we were learning that the demographics of the previous population, most of those people when they retired had 25 years of time. I now started to notice employees with a significantly less number of years. We also then started to experience some age-based discrimination issues. We had employees that found out when they were hired at age 51 that when they reached age 55, they were faced with this use-it or lose-it insurance benefit. And then if they decided to give up the benefit and continue to work beyond age 55, they were subjecting themselves to a physical. I had agency HR directors from corrections call me saying, this person is refusing to take the physical. What do we do? It became a growing concern for us. We asked the Attorney General's office for a legal opinion on requiring physicals for employees at a certain age. The Attorney General's opinion that came back to us said that for corrections officers, because of the exigencies of the job, you can have an age-based benefit, but they did raise concerns about the other job classes that have been added. We commonly refer to those as civilian job classifications because they don't come from that correctional officer series. Again, the proliferation grew with more and more people that were eligible for this insurance at age 55 with a relatively short period of time. I then brought this issue to the bargaining table and contract negotiations.
Excuse me. We're missing something here, because you talk about, I've been following this, and I was looking at this, and I asked for an attorney general. What was your position at that time? What was your position before your position now?
Well, we've always supported the program, Madam Chair. It's just that we're concerned about people that are moving into the correctional retirement plan.
No, what was your employee position? Where were you before your Office of Budget and Management?
I'm sorry. I was the, at that time, I was the Assistant State Negotiator for the Department of Employee Relations.
Okay. And have you been in any other, during this time period from 71 to now, what were your other positions so that we have...
Sure.
We know what your whole background is.
Sure, okay, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I started with the state in 1973 as a correctional officer at the correctional facility in St. Cloud. Back then we called it the Reform Authority. I worked as a correctional officer there from 1973 until 1980. And then in 1980 I left that job and then went to work for the union that represented correctional officers. And I represented the employees of the union business agent until the late 80s. And I have since then worked for the Department of Employee Relations since 1990. And I have been at the Department of Employee Relations, which is now in Minnesota's management and budget, since then. And so that's why I do know the history of the correctional retirement.
And when you were at the Department of Employee Relations, what was your position?
Assistant, Madam Chair, I was the Assistant State Negotiator.
And now you're Assistant Commissioner.
I am the Assistant Commissioner, yes.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Continuing on, the concerns that we have are the increasing number of people that when the legislature removed the 10-year vesting, the increasing number of employees that are eligible for this insurance with the 3 years of time. And then you should also be aware that when the language was put into the collective bargaining agreement, what we said was that you had to be eligible for the pension. And the reason that was put in that the language in the contract was at the time, back in 1983, there was 10-year vesting. And now with the 3-year vesting, that's the dilemma that we're faced with. So a couple of things, and I'm just about through with my testimony that I have for you. Family coverage right now for 10 years and our current projections is $160,000 per person, okay, based on 10% premiums each year. That's our analysis that we have. I have had limited luck, I should say, in the bargaining process, and I'm perfectly content with working on that, but there is a cost associated. But I think this commission needs to be aware of the financial impact of what's occurring here. We also have now the Equal Employee Opportunity Division has filed a probable cause ruling against us on that use it or lose it provision in the collective bargaining agreement. This will impact potentially 150 people who will be seeking damages against us as the state. I also have some more demographics that I want to share with you that currently right now in the correctional plan, employees that have retired with less than 5 years and are receiving the full employer contribution to the Department of Human Services, I have 30 employees that are getting the full benefit of the 10 years of insurance and they have less than 5 years. For the Department of Corrections, I have 69 employees that are getting this benefit for 5 years. For employees that have less than 10, we have 55 employees that are eligible they are retired and we are paying the insurance. In the Department of Corrections, we have 150 employees that are retired and have less than 10 years that we are paying the insurance. Madam Chair, in the next 2 years, we have 50 more employees that will be eligible for this benefit with the less than 10 years of insurance. So, as I reach the end in my testimony, we've never proposed to eliminate
the insurance. All we're trying to do is correct what we perceive to be an unintended windfall when we connected the insurance to the vesting, and the legislature reduced the vesting to 3 years. My experience with my counterparts in labor relations, most employers are getting out of this. We've never proposed to eliminate the benefit. All we wanted to do is correct it. We wanted to restore, we want to go back to the basic eligibility. This is becoming a huge cost item for us. The last, you heard the Commissioner Fabian say how much the insurance is costing. It was $5.4 million. Last year for the Department of Corrections and for the Department of Human Services, the contribution to the employer is over $1 million for 09. And as I said before, we've got another 50 employees that are coming down in the next 2 years that will be eligible for this insurance that will have less than 10 years. This is the problem. I'm willing to continue to work on it, but we're going to be spending an awful lot of money, and I think we need to be aware of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Larson. Could you submit those figures to us in writing, please? And what about your the numbers that you have for the human service part, the PP places, and the secure facility at St. Peter? How many...
Well,
how many
employees do we have, Madam Chair?
Are in the correction plan?
I think I would ask Mr. Birch to provide that data. I really, I'm not, I could give you a, I would say that total VHS employees in the correction retirement plan probably about 1,000. And then in the Department of Corrections, I would say that we probably have about 2,200. That would be my estimate on that. If Mr. Bergstrom wants to correct that, I agree.
Ms. Bergstrom, Ms. Benson, Mr. Benson. I thought at another meeting you gave me 150. Or 600.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the MSOP program. Excuse me. In the MSOP program, the number affected is 155. Now, in all of DHS, I believe it's around 1,500. That would be total. That would be SOS, the hospital system as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, I have that information from Mr. Bergstrom. We have the Department of Corrections has 2,855 employees in the Correction and Retirement Plan. And the Department of Human Services has 612.
Madam Chairman, certainly sympathetic to the financial implications of this, but was any of this presented to us at the time that these changes were made, or the adding of these positions? I think the thing, I think I have a certain sympathy for how we define people who are eligible for this plan. I was completely unaware of the number of people with very small number of years of service who are now, which you present us. Was any of this information presented to us?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, to the best of my knowledge, no, it was not. I mean, it was a phenomenon that developed. As I said before, in this original, when the plan was put in place, the correctional officers had significant length of service, and when those other civilian classes were added, I don't think anyone knew until it happened.
Madam Chairman, I had actually at one point thought that it was not legal to turn that a pension plan was turned like a contract, and it wasn't legal to change it after the people have been invested in it and so forth. And so I'm just interested if anyone has ever done this and if there have been any court cases on it.
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Pahn, I think that this is an issue that has some valid concerns, but nevertheless, we need to bring this to light. I do know that if you have someone that is 53 years old and applies for a job at the Department of Corrections, that or 52 years old, let's say, that applies for a job at the Department of Corrections, they have, if he's qualified or she's qualified, they have to accept that person and accept the impact of what the correctional plan would be, because you cannot turn someone's application down based on age. And this is becoming something that people are aware of out there.
Has anyone suggested that this be put in place for prospective hires instead of these changes we put in place for prospective hires? I mean, it seems with the numbers that you're giving us, you have lots of new people coming in at all times. And so what would be the financial effect of putting it in instead of putting it in on the backs of the people who are there already? No matter whose mistake it was, suppose we just immediately put it in, put the changes that are being suggested in place for prospective hires. What effect would that have?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Larson.
That certainly is a possibility. The only thing that I would say in response to that is, you know, as long as we're comfortable with the numbers, that we've got about 100 people right now that we're paying the insurance with less than 5 years, and we've got another 50 in the next 2 years coming, you know, at a certain point, I think we have to realize just how big the hemorrhaging is, or how much it is, and how fast we want to fix it.
Representative, we get into a big court case on this because we've interfered with obligations and we lose it. We haven't solved anything and we're out of the court cases on it. So my question was, has anyone done this and successfully done it?
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, my research on this has been that you do not change pension benefits for people who are retired. Okay. Now, we're not talking about changing I'm bringing you the issue of the insurance. And there are employers out there who have provided employer insurance and can no longer provide it. There are many government jurisdictions that once this cost mushroom got out of the business. In answer to the insurance issue, yes, they've done that. But they've not taken away from the people who are retired. And we're not proposing to take it away.
Sam
Jetzel. Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, it's a bit surprising to me to think that for many years now, maybe at least three administrations we're talking about, there have been people in their early 50s that have been seeking these jobs and getting these jobs, and nobody's noticed that they're going on for 3 years and that we're encouraging large insurance obligations. I mean, if this is a bombshell that's coming out, I mean, somebody should have been listening to this before now, isn't it? Correct.
And Chair Senator Bessel, I testified in front of the Pension Commission on this very testimony back in about 2003, explaining the situation almost identical to my testimony tonight. And so I have talked about this.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Larson, was there a bill proposed by the administration at that time?
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Bessel. No, there was.
Okay. I got a question because I don't understand what the impact will be on the current employees. If we were to adopt a proposal to move some individuals to the general retirement plan, does that mean that people right now who thought they would be retiring at age 55 would be moved into a different plan and would have to look beyond 55? Is that what the impact would be, or is it just the health benefits? I just don't understand what the practical impact would be for the people that are in these jobs today.
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Bessel, as I understand it, there hasn't been any actual legislation that I have seen finalized, but if the employee has more than 10 years in the correctional plan, they would still be able to retire with their correctional pension.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Betson.
Mr. Larson, Commissioner Larson. Again, you know, if the governor's proposal is adopted, and there's somebody in there that's affected by this, and they thought they're going to retire at age 55, but they're moved into a different, the general retirement plan. Does that mean that they are no longer able to retire at age 55, that they're going to have to work longer because they've been moved from the corrections plan into a different plan?
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the only time that that would apply is if they have less than the 10 years. Okay. They'd have to get to the 10 years.
Well, I'm not quite sure if I understand, but again, Commissioner, it seems to me, you talked about the fact that the retirement, the mandatory retirement age was moved up, and I think that people are living longer and working longer, but the people who are handling these kinds of positions deal with a fairly young and fairly dangerous crowd, and maybe the current inmates or patients leave, but newer and younger ones replace them. So I think when you get, you know, the type of employees we're talking about, I mean, beyond a certain age, you know, you really can't do this kind of work anymore. And so that's my concern, as you know, some individuals who are planning on retiring at age 55 may not be able to, because, and they're going to have to work longer when maybe physically they can't do these jobs anymore. So I think that's a major concern that I've got, that we can't force these people to do something that maybe they're physically able to do. Now, we were concerned as well, too, because we had a lot of requests for people to go into the plan for corrections, and so we set up a process by which we had corrections screen these positions, and we every year we would look at them, and I thought that we pretty much identified the people that had regular inmate contact, at least 75%, so we could figure out, because everybody would like to be in it, but obviously we wanted the people that actually had the direct contact, with the inmates or patients, to be affected by it. So I think that's why we set it up the way it was, recognizing that, it takes a certain amount of individuals to do this, but beyond age 55, it wasn't reasonable to expect them to do it. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilson.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering about, I share Representative Kahn's concerns with the legality of this. I had asked to have a proposal drafted that would have revised the pension benefits for political appointees who were getting the benefit of combining their years of service with the high five rule, and kind of providing a golden parachute for some people at the top of the ladder in terms of pensions, and really costing the state a lot of money. And I was told that you couldn't do that except prospectively. And I question that still, because those people are never bargained for those positions, and at least going forward, seems to me that since they're employees at will, that we should be able to make that change. But if you compare that to these people who bargained for this benefit, it seems to me like we should at least have maybe an opinion from the Attorney General's office or something about whether this is a legal option to even consider before we would spend our time on it.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Johnson, or Commissioner. I guess the question I have, and it falls kind of along the same line as yours, as these people, as these people are paying into this, the state's paying a higher percentage or a higher dollar amount into it for these employees. Do the employees pay a higher amount than they would if they were in the general plan? I guess that's my first question.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Larson.
That is correct. They do.
So, in effect, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, in effect, so then these people have been paying for this, and granted, I know about the actuarials, and I know that 3 years probably isn't enough to fund what the cost is going to be that they paid extra for, but they've been paying extra for this, and now they're being taken away from it, or it's being taken away from them, and again, this is something they bargained for. It's sort of like going back on a contract and saying, okay, 5 years ago we overpaid you, or we didn't want to pay you that much, so we're going to take the money away from you now. And I just don't, I guess I don't know if that's legal, and if it's legal, I don't know if it's the moral thing to do. These people took these jobs with these understanding. They took these jobs knowing what the what the job condition was, but also what the benefits were, and they weigh that out in their mind when they switched into these jobs, and now they're being punished because the state's trying to balance their budget on the backs of employees that have paid in for benefits that they expected to have, and now they're not going to have them. I don't know if there's a question there or not, but that's, like I said, I don't know if this is the legal or moral thing to do, and I think before we would go on with this, we'd have to really make sure it's the legal thing to do. I know in my pension plan that I have on the outside, there was things where they went in and they prospectively, going forward, eliminated the ability for the rule of 90, although we have the rule of 88, but it's the same principle. They've raised, they've lowered payment out, but they've done that for going forward, that the multiplier on the plan is has been lowered, but that but the existing multiplier on existing money is stayed there. And I know it's not a public pension plan, but I know that, like I said, I have some trouble with this. I guess that's the statement I'm going to make. I have some trouble looking at this and doing this. We're hurting people that paid for something they thought they were going to get, and now we're taking it away from them.
Commissioner Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I certainly understand the position that you've taken, but I do think it's important to distinguish between what Commissioner Fabian testified about the pension plan versus the insurance benefit. The insurance benefit, when it was negotiated in 1983, said you had to be eligible for the annuity. And at that time, the vesting period was 10 years. And we were comfortable. We were willing to say, we'll pay your 10 years of insurance if you have 10 years of service with us. And when the legislature reduced the vesting down to 3 years, that's when it became a concern. And there is nothing in the labor agreement that specifically says 3 years. But the legislature could say vesting is 6 months. You could say it's 1 day. You could say it's 10 years. You control the vesting period, and when you reduce the vesting period and you did not have the same amount of time specified in that agreement, that's when we created this problem. And we're just bringing it to your attention.
Well, we appreciate that, but the vesting that went down from 10 years to 5 years in 1987, and then from 5 years to 3 years in 89, and that's not when the new correction plan was adopted.
I'm sure that's correct, but back then all we had were correctional officers, and the correctional officers typically are 25 years of service before they retire. It's those 600 people that we added in 1995. We're hiring those people at 51, 52 years old.
And tell me again.
Well,
please, Commissioner Larson, say again. What is contained in their pension plan? In their pension plan is that they have to have
3 years
of service. In or and they have to retire at 55? Do they have to retire at 55?
I'm sure they don't need to know.
They have the choice of retiring at 55.
I'm sure that is correct.
After just 3 years of service.
That is correct, and they can go on their pension in 3 years.
Did they have some other service before they came at age 53 or 50 or 51?
Madam Chair, looking at the demographics, what we find is that there are a lot of employees that are hired and new to the state system in the correctional plan that are 50, 51 years old. Those are the people that are faced with that use it or lose it in some of our correctional bargaining things. But we do have people that do join the correctional plan from general plan jobs as well.
I always thought that the majority of people in the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services in the secure facilities worked from early, the majority worked from early age up and got promoted and promoted and promoted kind of things. And so they wouldn't have, although age-wise they may very well be in that situation, but they had to have some experience to get hired at age 53 or 51 or something like that in the Department of Corrections. They just take people off the street and put them in there and say, you're going to be, we're going to hire you because you're... got certain burliness, or and the teachers that are there that have been working all these years, they 75% of the time they're just, well, we'll still get them to work for us.
Madam Chair, there are a lot of people, this is the first time they've been hired. If you take, for example, a dentist in the early correctional, and we hired them, and 52 years old, they've never worked with
them. Just came out of the Army.
I'm not sure about that, but no, we do have a lot of people that are first time in a lot of those jobs of that nature that maybe hired at that age.
You know, I remember when this bill, when the bill to put the teachers and the nurses and the psychologists especially into the plan was adopted, and one of the reasons, and when that was done, you know, the nurses were, there were physicians working in the department, real doctors, and then as a cost-saving thing over the years, we went from real doctors to maybe a nurse working in each facility or so. And the nurses, what they're doing now compared to what they were doing then, isn't even measurable. And I just can't imagine that if you're going to lose people, or if you're going to throw these people out and say, you just have ordinary value to us now, that you're going to get anybody applying for these positions. And teachers, too. I just can't imagine it.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's, again, Commissioner Fabian talking about her part to this, but I'm telling you that what you need to be aware of, that if you hire someone that is 52 years old, that works in that correctional facility until 55, we're certainly going to be on the hook with that family coverage for $166,000. And you just need to be aware of that. And as long as everyone's aware of that, I'm fine with that. As long as you're aware, that's the concern, is that this is becoming known out there. Over the 3 years, we're going to get 10 years of insurance. And if you're comfortable with that, then that's, I understand what you're saying. I know that when that plan was first put in place, you had to be vested in it for 10 years, and that was linked to that insurance. That's gone when you reduce the vesting period. And as I said before, you've got 100 people right now that are getting that insurance less than 5 years.
And, Commissioner, so it's not the pension plan where you're going to be saving money. It's the collective bargaining agreement where they've contracted for the insurance, where you're going to be saving money. Am I correct?
Well, again, Madam Chair and Commissioner Fabian's on the eligibility. I just want to focus on the insurance. When we agreed to the insurance, you had to be vested in the plan. And at that time, the legislature said you had to have 10 years. And so that's what we were comfortable with. I believe the state negotiator made a mistake, and the state negotiator should have said you had to have 10 years in order to get the insurance. That would have clarified that they linked it to this eligibility for the pension. Unbeknownst to everybody, when we reduce that to 3 years, they're eligible for the pension at 3 years, so we're then obligated for 10 years of insurance. And that's what happened.
And
you
that,
need to be aware of it.
And that 3 years happened in 89. When did the vesting for 10 years with the insurance, what year did that take place?
1983.
In 1983. And we haven't renegotiated a contract with the insurance since 1983?
Madam Chair, we negotiate insurance every 2 years.
Every 2 years, insurance is renegotiated.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
This isn't
stuff. Well, no. Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, so what would have prevented you at any time in those every two-year negotiations from simply saying it's going to be a 10-year period to vest. I mean, you wouldn't have been stuck with the what you're calling a mistake that was made in 89 or 83. I mean, so people would have had a chance at any time along the way if you had wanted to negotiate that change to say yes or no, I'll work under those conditions going forward, instead of just retroactively taking it away from people after they've already worked for that benefit under an agreement. That seems to me to be a little hard to understand how you're trying to portray this as something you've had no control over since 89 if you've renegotiated this every 2 years.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Larson.
Senator Olson, Madam Chair, there's nothing that's prevented you from fixing this at the bargaining table. We haven't made that decision. That's been a decision you've made in the bargaining process. That's no different than anything else, whether it's schools or whatever. I mean, you have had that. I don't understand that statement. I mean, just because you have authorization to have a certain pool of money, why have we made that decision for you?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, when we originally placed this, agreed on this, we agreed under the premise that we thought the legislature wouldn't have reduced the vesting period. So it's really kind of put us in a position where we're trying to dig ourselves out of this hole, and it's stuck. So that's the information that we're needing to bring you. It was very tough that we reduced that for 2 years and we didn't know it.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have perhaps a question for the Chair. This Corrections Department change item order, is this on tonight's calendar or agenda for informational purposes
yes,
only?
Yes. Yes, it is, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Smith.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I wanted to just kind of clarify that because this is a governor's recommendation. This is not a bill. The governor is not a member of the House or the Senate. He's not here offering a bill to do this. It's just a recommendation as part of the biennial process of the governor proposing his recommendations. And frankly, I've never seen a budget book presentation before in the Pensions Commission or any commission that I'm aware of. This is a change item, and it's good perhaps to get this information, but unless and until you would try to set precedent and require us to vote on this, I'm not getting too upset over the governor's recommendation.
And I appreciate that, Representative Smith, and I said those exact words at the beginning, that it was an introduction.
I missed the first one.
And the reason I brought it to the attention of the commission is because it's being claimed as a pension issue and a savings. But really, it's equally as much, if not more, of a savings on the insurance thing, which is not written in the pension status at all. And I sat through Finance Committee last week and listened to several people, and Commissioner Hansen present the governor's proposed budget. And he went all the way through without mention this issue at all. And at the very end, I had to bring it to the attention of the pension or of the finance committee. And so I didn't know if in other subsequent presentations in the House or the Senate, if it was being mentioned in the appropriate places. And I certainly think that since it's taking some thousand people or more out of a pension plan and changing the pension plan, that we should be aware, even though it is just a proposal and we have not seen a bill on it.
Madam Chair, thank you. I did miss the first 2 minutes in your introduction. I just want you to know that you have my support in this commission for whatever you do within reason. And I have also noticed that, with tongue-in-cheek perhaps, I haven't seen any other element in either the House or the Senate come up with counter-proposals yet to the governor's recommendation, and I was just wondering if you wanted this commission to lead that charge.
Well, you know, and I take your suggestion very close to my heart, Representative Smith, and, you know, my brain here is quickly coming to an end. And so I'm not going to make any proposal tonight. Sarah Rosen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I will actually defer to Representative Smith's comments, but I do look forward to this coming in front of Public Safety Budget, which I do serve on, and I think when it does come before us, we'll have a good discussion.
Representative Nelson.
I think we're kind of winding down here, as I said, so I think I'll defer my question for
Commissioner Fabian, Commissioner Larson, thank you very much. And I probably should tell people that are here not for the corrections issue that I also brought it up because I was the author of the bill that put the people in, the additional people in 1995. And it is dear to my heart. And it was my last meeting. Representative Nelson, number four.
Can we nominate them all at once? And is it a slate? Yes. I would like to nominate Senator Bethel to chair the Pension Commission with Representative Murphy as the vice chair and nominate Representative Smith as the secretary.
Is there any additional nominations? Any discussion? Not sent to Representative Nelson. Did you move it?
I moved the nominee.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Congratulations.
Or condolences.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to review a little bit of history here. I was talking to Brian Rice coming on in here, and it's an honor to have two former House chairs on the Pension Commission, Representative Smith and Representative Murphy. Senate chairs don't tend to last very long past their tenure, however. You might have noticed that. I came on the Pension Commission in 1997, and Senator Steve Morse was the chair at that time. And then in 1999, Representative Maris in the House took the gavel, and Senator Morris nominated me to be vice chair. I'd only been on 2 years, and I thought, well, not a big deal because Senator Morris will still be here. Well, that was on Friday. The following Monday, he announced he was leaving the Senate to be the deputy DNR commissioner. So I thought, what have I been set up for? So for the next, 2 years, I was wondering, does that mean I have to be the chair next? And I was basically down to Senator Pogemiller and me, I think. And fortunately, the Republican senator who was on the Pension Commission, Dean Johnson, then joined the Senate DFL caucus. So Senator Pogemiller and I went to Senator Johnson and said, guess what, you're the next chair of the Pension Commission. And so he gladly accepted it, served his 2 years, then he got off the commission. And then the gavel passed to Representative Smith, and for the next 2 years, it was basically on Senator Pogemiller and me again, and Senator Pogemiller said that Bethel will be the next chair of the Pension Commission. And the day of the, Representative Smith gave up the gavel, I was sitting next to him, and he leaned over to me and said, well, who are you going to nominate? I said, Senator Pogemiller, and I long remember the look on your face when I said that. And then I made the motion, and you could hear the audible gasp in the room. Well, what happened the day before, I went to Senator Pogano, and I said, I know you want me to chair it, but Larry, you know, Minneapolis Teachers is coming up this year, and you represent Minneapolis, and we really need your leadership here, and you're the only one who can do it. And he bought it. So now for the last 2 years, as Representative Murphy's been chairing the Pension Commission, I was thinking, well, you know, we've got Dan Larson. He's been here for 10 years, and he probably would like that. Or even Senator Morgan. I mean, she's the Assistant Minority Leader, and they both left the Pension Commission. So I proudly and gladly accept the gavel to be the chair of the Pension Commission. Now, I just spend a minute or two here and just kind of lay out the next... Just procedurally, you know, what I kind of like to look at for the next, 2 years or so. The one thing that has been really tough on all of us, I mean, the members of this Pension Commission and our staff work extremely, extremely hard. We've done it the whole time that I've been on it. And they're dedicated. We work in a bipartisan manner. But when March Madness hits around this place, it is really, really tough, on all of us. You know, we have... maybe long floor sessions, and then we go to committee meetings and caucus meetings, and the next thing you know, then we come here for a Pension Commission meeting at 7 o'clock at night, and we stay here well past midnight, and one by one, people get their issues heard, we've got 30 bills to hear or something, and they leave, and, we're the last ones to go. And, we work hard, but we're exhausted, and it's very difficult to do. We try as hard as we can. But I just don't know that we always do our best work, under those circumstances. I'd like to try to get a little bit ahead of the curve if I can. But it's going to mean, trying to make some adjustments and, frankly, getting our work done a little earlier. We already know the first committee deadline is March 27th. The joint rules do say that we have to have a bill out of the policy committees by the second deadline. Now, I did make a proposal to the Senate Rules Committee to amend the joint rules to give us a little bit of leeway to the third committee deadline. I don't know that that's going to happen. So the rules still say second committee deadline, and of course, that is the busiest time of the session. I mean, we're, the first and second deadlines, we're trying to get a quorum together. Even if we can get a quorum, people are leaving, because they've got other meetings to go to. Even getting a room is very difficult sometimes, and so... I'd like not to press the work into the busy time period if we can. What I'd like to be able to do is to start meeting probably on Fridays, not this coming Friday, this is too soon, but, starting a week from Friday, just trying to, schedule some meetings and starting to get the work out of the way. Now, it also means, we've got some bills introduced, and I asked for a list of the bills that have been introduced today. There's 12 bills. So far, and I'm aware of a couple of other bills that are on their way, and maybe one or two issues that have to be heard. But we just can't keep the door open and let everybody keep bringing in bills, and we're just going to keep processing and do them. So I'm thinking about just drawing a line and saying, okay, if by a certain date a bill isn't introduced, the chances are it may not be heard. And I'm looking at around March 6th, and March 6th is, we've been here 2 months. 2 months, the session's over by March, and that's a Friday. But I'm thinking if a bill hasn't been introduced by that time period, there's going to be a strong reason for it, to expect us to have, get to this. There'll be exceptions. There's going to be an emergency issue that we hadn't thought of. There's going to be maybe one of our colleagues who's now on the Pensions Commission coming in with a simple little bill dealing with one constituent. I mean, there's probably room for maneuvering here. But if it's a major issue and somebody's out there sitting on the bill or walking around with it in their briefcase and trying to get co-authors on a bill, and then they come in, at the last minute and say, fit this on, I don't know. Now, what I'd like to do, frankly, is, again, finish the bill up as we can before the committee deadlines start hitting, and then some work that we just don't get to during the session, kick it over to the interim and have meetings over the interim. You don't have to have a bill actually introduced to bring an issue before the Pension Commission. We have staff over the summer that, they can draft up proposals and so forth, and maybe can start working on those and hearing them and, kind of fleshing out the details over the summer. So that I think if we do our work and get these issues brought to us over the interim, you know, maybe we can have a bill pretty much done by the time the session starts in 2010. Again, there's going to be a few new issues coming on up. You've got to tie up together some loose ends. But rather than waiting until the session starts in 2010 for everybody to start bringing their bills to us and expect that we're going to start processing, I'd like to meter it out over the interim. They don't have to do it, but I think if they wait until the start of the 2010 session, we may not have a lot of time left to look at it. Now, then that gets us through the 2010 session, and we've adjourned sine die. And then you got that interim after 2010. Major announcement for those people who have been paying attention. 2010, the House and the Senate are up for re-election. Okay? Let me say that again. In 2010, the House and the Senate are up for re-election. So I don't think we're going... So this is the gospel, but as far as Pension Commission members go, you know, trying to get members in over that particular time period probably is going to be very difficult at best. So I don't anticipate we're going to be able to be doing a lot of work, you know, between the end of the 2010 session and the starting of 2011. So, again, what I'm looking at is finishing the bill as we can this session, working over the interim, you know, hearing as many issues as we can, you know, having people, you know, if they've got long-range plans, bring them in, let's talk about them, we've got the time to do it, and then and doing it that way. So that's my goal anyway. I mean, I'm certainly open to, you know, issues that the Pension Commission members have and, you know, what you want to do, but I do look forward, you know, to working with each one of you and hoping that, you know, we're going to do some work, as we've done in the past. We've had excellent leadership in the past, and I hope to provide similar in the future. So anything further to come before the Pension Commission, by any way? President Murphy, any last words before we adjourn?